And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to have Beth Macy on the program today. Beth is a journalist having written for the Roanoke Times and has contributed essays to the New York Times. She's written two best-selling books of nonfiction. The first was Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town. And today we'll be talking about the latest, Truvine, Two Brothers, a Kidnapping, and a Mother's Quest, a True Story of the Jim Crow South, which is published by Little Brown. Beth, how had you first heard of George and Willie Muse?
So I was a young newspaper reporter for the Roanoke Times in Virginia, and I was riding around with a photographer one day on an assignment. I don't remember what it was, but you know, photographers always have the best story ideas because they tend to move around more than reporters do. They have more assignments. And this particular photographer was a white photographer who had grown up in Roanoke, and he told me about this incredible story about two albino African-American young brothers who were kidnapped from a rural tobacco field about an hour south of Roanoke in Truvine, and they were sold to the circus. And he said, quote, "It's the best story in town, but nobody's been able to get it." And kind of both the story put the hair on the back of my neck, and so did that comment, because I'm just a little bit competitive. And I thought, oh, well, let me try. And I said, why can't anybody get it? And he said, well, the keeper of the story is the caretaker of the last living brother. And at the time, he was in his 90s. And the keeper was this soul food restaurateur named Nancy Saunders, and her restaurant was called The Goody Shop. And it was quite the hangout spot, amazing food. And so the first time I saunter in there, probably around 1991, saying, hi, it's Beth Macy from the Roanoke Times. I would love to write a story about your great uncle, Willie, and what happened to he and his brother, George. She pointed to a sign that a customer had given her, and it was handmade block stencil on the wall. And the sign said, sit down and shut up. And she meant it. So she had been kind of protecting them since they retired in the early 60s, because whenever they would come to town, people would like gawk at them because they knew they were these famous circus, quote, freaks. And some of her first memories was of people banging on their door demanding to see the savages that eat raw meat. And I mean, these are black and white people just very curious about them. And so I realized when the photographer told me the tale, well, A, I didn't know whether it was true, but B, like people in our town over a certain age, they had all grown up with this legend. And there was one of them still alive and living in the neighborhood not far from the restaurant. But she clearly didn't want the story to be told, and I honored that.
How long did it take you to earn her trust?
Well, I wouldn't presume to think that I have all of her trust now. She's tough, and I just told you why she's tough. Just imagine like the taunts that she grew up with as a kid in school and in the neighborhood. But they had this restaurant, and it was Nancy was the main baker. Her mother, Dot, and her cousin Louise, and her Aunt Martha ran it. And I mean, they could throw down some Southern food. And Dot was in the back. The first time I went in, Dot was in the back peeling potatoes and watching Young and the Restless. And I'm probably the only person you know who actually remembers the very first episode of Young and the Restless. Wasted a lot of my time as a child watching Young and the Restless. So anyways, like that was my in with Dot, because we started talking about the characters. Of course, they're the very same people and the very same actors, you know, 20 years later. And Dot and I sort of really hit it off. And Dot convinced Nancy to let me write a restaurant article about the Goody Shop. And the Goody Shop was one of those amazing places in a fairly still segregated city that all the African Americans in town knew about it and went there. Almost no whites went there. So she reluctantly let me do a feature on the restaurant. I mean, the sign sit down and shut up was featured in the story. I think I captured the essence of Nancy Saunders in the story. It was pretty funny. Talked about the food and just how it was this community scene. But it was kind of like this invisible place to the white community. And that became kind of my charge at the newspaper. Like, those were the kinds of stories I liked to write. I liked to write stories that other people didn't know about, by and large, in the white community. I mean, that was kind of the challenge. And that almost became my beat. I mean, I made it my beat. I asked for it to be my beat, and it was turned down. And then I just kept pitching these irresistible stories that were mostly in the black community or in the refugee community or the immigrant community. And that's, if you look at my record, that's most of what I've spent most of my time covering as a newspaper reporter.
And it's amazing enough to look at the racism of the time and how it was in the broader white community, but your fellow journalists back in the day weren't immune from just terrible, terrible racism in their writing.
Yeah, and don't think it was just little old Roanoke, Virginia.
No, it was the New York Times.
It was the New York Times. It was the New Yorker, the New York Sun. It was the Washington Post. I mean, when I finally figured out when we were doing the series in 2001 and we figured out the moment when Harriet got their sons and then we were able to go to the old microfilm and see in the Roanoke Times how it was covered, I wasn't surprised that they never once interviewed her. They quoted her in dialect without interviewing her and really mocked her and sort of acted like she was making it all up. It was covered the way the circus was always covered, which is sort of like a wink-wink from the press agent to the reporter, not taken seriously at all. But then later, once I got access to all these other newspaper archives, and I truly saw how 10 years, 15, 20 years later, there was much more available online, much more searchable databases and things available to me when I wrote the book, I was able to see how widely the story was covered. I mean, all over the country, but also how it wasn't just the Southern newspapers that mocked the family. It was the New York Times. When they finally went back the next year, they were in the headline, "Eco and Iko are happy." And then in the story, finally, after 10 years, they have the permission of their parents to join the circus. No mention of the trafficking. The New Yorker said in 1928, when they went back, first it made fun of the way they walked and it said they went back to the circus because in Roanoke, the fried chicken had given out.
Because of this type of coverage they received, you can't really trust the newspaper reports, the newspaper of record, to have a definitive and correct view of history. And you have the family's view of what happened. So where do you think the truth lies in
all
this?
Right. Early on, a circus historian, really wonderful gentleman named Dick Flint, he said it's going to be really hard finding information about them in the databases once you get access to them because they would change their names all the time. So they weren't just Eco and Iko. They were also Darwin's Missing Links and the Ecuadorian Savages and all this. And he said, your best evidence is going to be photographic because you can't argue with a photograph. So I went digging through these various circus museum archives, looking not just for actual photographs of people, but also photographs of sideshow banners. So along the outside of the sideshow tent, there would be these paintings of the acts that were inside, trying to entice you to pay your extra quarter to go in the sideshow tent. So that's what I started looking at rather than just Googling words or putting words in databases. The picture that blows me away the most in the book is this picture unearthed in a collector's collection out of Florida. It's a guy who his whole life, a wealthy benefactor who his whole life collected photographs of the circus because his hobby in his off hours was to build little model circuses. And he doesn't care anything about the sideshow, but he happened to have this amazing photograph of George and Willie Muse. And it was a photograph of them. I've showed it to a lot of people, and we think they're approximately 12 and 15 in this picture. And then what I did was, like, I look at the picture, and to me, they just look like scared young boys. I assume they're fairly young to the circus. They haven't been traveling for a while. But then I sent it to a historic costume expert named Joshua Bond at the College of Charleston. And he said, he blew it up, and he said, no, they've been wearing these suits for a long time. These suits are two sizes too small. They've probably been wearing them over a year. He pointed out the seams that were stretching. He pointed out they were actually, it was a nice suit. Like, they wanted them to look nice, but the way they were wearing them and the fact that they were too small and they were sort of dirty and stretched out, they were sort of being cared for, but not really that carefully. And then I just studied the pictures. And I did that, you know, there's another picture in 1917, the first time they're holding instruments. So one of the stories that the family always told was that they would comfort Georgie would comfort Willie, the younger brother. And during World War I, there was a really popular song called It's a Long Way to Tipperary. They loved that song. They would sing it in their act. They sang that song their whole lives. It's a really important song in the book. It's a World War I anthem about missing home for the soldiers. I showed that picture to Nancy, and she said, oh, yeah. And interviewed her so long, over so many years, there are still stories that I think she's told me everything, but she hasn't. Because, you know, as a journalist, you kind of have to help people remember things that they've grown up hearing. It's not news to them. So when she saw that photograph, she remembered that Willie would talk about the first time they were handed instruments, it was just for a photo prop. For one of those photo pitch cards, and that was an extra way that the managers would make money. They would sell photos of the acts to patrons. And so this was a photo pitch card, and they're both holding various instruments, and there's other instruments at the ground. And the joke was on the show manager because it turned out they were really good musicians. Now, we don't know exactly when they learned how to play, if they're totally self-taught. I'm sure they were mostly self-taught, but Willie's actually holding the banjo in clawhammer style, which is a common style to Franklin County, Virginia, where they're from, Southern Piedmont blues. And eventually, I mean, by all accounts, they could hear a song once and play it on almost any instrument. And
it's almost the cliche about people with vision problems that they can do that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Whether it's true he abducted them or came into their lives a few months later, their manager slash captor, mm-hmm. Candy Shelton, was a huge part of why they couldn't go home.
Exactly. So he took, quote, possession, and that's the word they used, of him sometime in the late 19-teens, working for a circus owner called Algie Barnes. And then Algie Barnes later writes a memoir in the early 30s bragging about buying them and, quote, making them a paying proposition. And they were literally treated like chattel, which is shocking when you read it, but it's just a reflection of the way most white people viewed black people in
when
the first half of the
peonage
last,
after the Civil War.
Yeah. Nobody asks a question about, well, these are children and they're traveling around on the train with these men and where's their mother and what's happened to them? Are they being compensated? Are they getting this quarter that I'm giving? Nobody thought to ask those questions.
What were racial attitudes like amongst the performers in the sideshow?
The brothers always told the relatives that they were basically treated like white people. Most of the people on the sideshow were white, not all. I don't know if that's true. I interviewed somebody who actually performed with them, with Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey, back in 2001. You know, he could tell. He looked down on them. He said, yeah, I heard they were kidnapped. I also heard they were from Mars. He was very dismissive of them even then. I mean, he was in his 90s then. And he couldn't for the life of him figure out why somebody would want to write about George and Willie Muse. And that, to me, was like a snapshot of the way they were viewed by white people in the sideshow.
Also, albinism amongst people of African descent is relatively more common than amongst Caucasian or European peoples. What were the attitudes toward people with albinism in the African-American community back at the turn of the century?
Yeah, I think in both the white and the black communities, it was really difficult. The people I interviewed about albinism said, you know, even today, sometimes if a child is born with albinism, just out of the blue, no one else in the family that's happened to, fathers have questioned, is that really my child? And you can imagine what 100 years ago, when science and medicine was all sort of new, what the attitude would have been like about it then. I mean, they had three members of their family had albinism, three of the five children. So these are all just questions I wish I could have asked him, you know. One of the things that the genetics expert I interviewed about albinism said was people, especially back then, a lot of people with albinism had a condition where their eyes oscillated. It was, I can't remember the exact name of the condition, but it was commonly known as dancing eyes. And that was, people just assumed they were mentally deficient because their eyes couldn't focus. And I think that may have been part of why the brothers were always discounted in the press and that it was just misinterpreted.
A lot of people assumed that they had developmental difficulties where they were told to keep their mouth shut, essentially, on stage or speak gibberish because no one really wanted to know. They were just two nice young men from Southern Virginia.
Right, who were taken away from their mother and told she was dead.
And the wide range of ways they were marketed, as you said, as cannibals, as sheep-headed mm-hmm. men from South America, from mm-hmm. Ecuador, but then ambassadors from Mars. And so there's a legitimate reason for them not to speak English there, but it actually gives them some form of status as well.
It's exactly. And that was when they got to wear really nice tuxedos, and their act later, like the late 20s, 30s, it took on almost a comic undertone. It was like everybody knew it was a joke at this point. And you can tell in the pictures, so they just seem more relaxed. They also happen to be, this is after their mothers found them, gotten lawyers involved. Now they're being paid and they're being allowed to visit their mother and their family in the off season. So they were happier. And they always told their relatives that it was our choice to go back once we knew we could come home and see our mother.
You write about how they and other sideshow performers, and I've heard it from other people talking about the 10-in-1 show, as it's mm-hmm. sometime called, that they didn't feel bad about being part of the sideshow because it gave them a chance to earn their own living and not be viewed as objects of charity.
Yeah. And they would say, they're laughing at us, but we're laughing at them because they're paying to see us. Which is a great quote, I think.
Well, and they called the spectators rubes.
Oh, yeah. Everyone in the circus did. I mean, those poor and sophisticated rubes, they're not like us. We're traveling all over the country, and we're living these kind of dangerous, exciting lives. People are coming out to see us as we get off the train. Look at the lot lice. That was what they called the little kids that would show up when the circus trains would unload at 6 or 7 in the morning after driving all night. If they didn't have money to go to the circus, they would try to at least get a peek of the spectacle of 1,600 people and 900 horses and camels. And, you know, just imagine it was like 20 zoos unloading, and it was like a movable city that moved around by night.
Well, you talked about how huge the circus was as a form of entertainment at that time, mm-hmm. and that 15,000 people a day could go see a big top show.
Yeah. So between 1840 and 1940, it was the predominant form of entertainment. So that's before movies were big, before TV, before film, before professional sports were really big. And so this coincides with the industrializing nation, and people are finally having a little bit of leisure time. Not a lot, not like we have today, but a little bit of leisure time, and still not a lot of money. Like, a lot of families aren't going on vacation yet. But when the circus comes to town, they can save up their pennies, and that's what they can do. And that after Christmas Day, Circus Day was the biggest day of the year. It's hard to imagine.
And it's funny to see that there was like a pecking order that circuses looked down on carnivals. And
yes.
Then there was a thing I'd never heard of before called the Dime Museum.
Oh, yeah. That which preceded it all. Yeah. In Barnum's time. That's like 1840s to 1860s. The idea was we would look at scientific pursuits in a setting that wasn't just a bar, and this would be an intellectual thing. But the thing that always caught the most attention were the differently abled people.
There was one act named Eskimo Minnick from Greenland, and he pretty much summed up America to a T when he said, "You're a race of scientific animals."
Oh, yeah. He was talking about the Museum of Natural History, that when his father died, they faked a funeral, put a log and covered it in fur, and he thought his father was buried, and then he found out that they were exhibiting him in the basement of the museum. The wonderful book by Ken Harper that came out in 1986 called Give Me Back My Father's Bones. I think that's the title. He got to be educated, and he actually got to go back to Greenland, and then he didn't feel at home there either. Almost like the brothers when they got home and didn't really feel like at home because they were more familiar with the circus. And then he came back to New York. They still wouldn't give him his father's body. And he eventually found a little bit of happiness in Vermont or New Hampshire. He was working with a farm family, and then he died tragically in the flu epidemic of 1918.
But he just pointed to that lack of basic human decency that we miss in ourselves so often.
Yeah, that's right. And all the big papers of the day mocked him too. It's really something to try to put your head back in that mindset.
Nowadays, we think of Billboard magazine as just dealing with records and radio and the music industry. But back in the day, it was very important for all types of entertainment business. And that's why their mother, Harriet Muse, had advertised to see if she could find her boys that way.
Yes, it covered the entertainment world, which was the circus. So most of Billboard magazine was circuses followed by carnivals. I mean, the whole thing. It would have all the route listings. It would have, if you got mail, like if somebody sent you mail, Billboard would list your name and you were supposed to go to the box and get your mail. There's all these great circus lingo words, but they nicknamed it the educator because it helped people figure out what was going on in the industry. And it gave people who really wanted to like drop everything and join the circus. It was this little window into what that life might be like. And that was like an entertaining, that was just like an exciting kind of dangerous thought that you might just go off with the circus.
Did she ever get any responses to that classified?
Not that I could find out. She didn't get them back for another 13 years, so I'm assuming the answer is no. But it occurred to me, maybe she didn't write it. She was illiterate. You could tell a friend of hers was mentioned in it, and you were supposed to write this showman who had initially was their manager. You were supposed to write him if you had any knowledge of their whereabouts. But he may have actually written it because he was dying to get a good-paying act back. So it's just hard to know. Once you've really studied the coverage, you realize it's all bunk. I mean, you can't really trust any of it. Exactly. I mean, you can trust it if the circus was in Kansas City last Thursday. I mean, you can trust it there. But it was all just spoon-fed by press agents for the most part.
And the neighborhood Harriet Muse lived in was called Ballyhack in Roanoke. And beyond George and Willie being genetically unique, there was also another famous person whose genetics would go on to be hugely influential in the world, and as Henrietta Lacks lived in that neighborhood.
Right, right. That was actually called Jordan's Alley. Ballyhack was where she lived out in the county.
Oh, out in the country, okay.
Where she was able to buy land for the first time because of what she held the circus accountable to. But before that, they lived in the poorest section of town in the west end of Roanoke. And only the old, very old people there remember it being called Jordan's Alley. But it was
Some
right by the
ramp.
Somebody
said Jordan's Alley.
Yeah,
wasn't?
Jordan's Alley. Wow, you read it really well. You know, so I drove around with a lot of older people just trying to bring that world to life. It's still the poorest neighborhood in the city with over 98% free and reduced lunch rate.
And you tell a horrible story of a woman that froze to death in the rented house that she lived in.
Right, owned by the same company, the slumlord company that owned a lot of the houses. And somebody said, you didn't want to rent from them, but you had to because they were the cheapest. And a domestic worker in her 70s froze to death in one of those houses, a lot like the house that George and Willie came home to in 1927. This was many years later, but those stories enabled me to see the conditions of that house and to see the layout of that house and what it looked like. And I was able to, you know, through court records and old building permits to find out that the house they came home to after being sort of famous circus stars and possibly mistreated, maybe treated okay, so their act would look okay. But so when they came home, people still wanted to gawk at them all the time. And they lived in a 517 square foot little two-room shack with no running water. And all these houses kind of facing different directions on this dirt road that was called 10 and a half Street. It didn't even merit a full number. And it was right by the railroad tracks. And this is the steam era. So you've got cinders flying and all the noise of the trains coupling. And very evocative kind of place. But it just a block away was where I think her name at the time was Loretta Pleasant. And that she became Henrietta Lacks. And so you've got these two really strong female characters whose stories had never been told. And I love that. I think they should put up a statue to both of them in that neighborhood.
In order to force Candy Shelton and the circuses they work for to pay them, Harriet got a lawyer who they referred to as Lawyer Messick.
Right, right. Lawyer Messick was the first lawyer she got back in 1927. And he actually was a very famous Virginia litigator. People would actually leave their office during their lunch hour if he was going to be delivering his closing remarks. Like, that was the entertainment of the day. And he was so good, he could bring his own self to tears during his closing remarks. And he kind of botched the case at first, but then ended up refiling and got her a settlement. We don't know how much, but we know it was the first time the family had some big money. And then later,
The second lawyer, I forgot his name.
The second lawyer was Wilbur Austin. And he was kind of a mousy guy that was always running his hand through his hair and fidgety, moving his glasses, and, you know, had a lot of prominent lawyers in the family. And he was kind of the least favorite of them. And also, his relatives have no idea what he had done in this case. He's representing this poor black woman. It's probably not even a case he talked about at home, but it was very much a big part of what he did. So he basically, working with Harriet, had the brothers declared incompetent. On the legal documents, it says practically imbeciles, which sounds horrible. It was. But it was the way that when Candy Shelton would switch him from Ringling to a lesser ethical circus, and then he would continue pocketing their money, then there was a legal system in place that would ensure that they would be hunted down wherever they were. Sometimes they were in Canada. Sometimes they were in Florida, California. Lawyer Austin would go and find the brothers with the help of Pinkerton detectives and missing persons people. And he would find them and he would make the circus pay up, issue a new contract, and all have to go through the courts. And that was my lucky find halfway through, as I found all these old court documents. Every single penny had to be documented and had to go through the judge.
And he had a right-hand man, I've forgotten his name as well, that he would take along with him because he didn't drive himself.
He didn't drive. So the right-hand man, his name was John Halp, and I saw that all over the court records. Who is John Halp? So I found out he died in the 50s. He had a son. His son had passed away. How am I going to find out about John Halp? Well, because I had spent so many months driving around this Jordan's Alley neighborhood with these older ladies, or I was getting ready to at that point, but I had their names and I was making contacts, and I had a friend of mine who was the newspaper's first black reporter. She is from that neighborhood. She goes to the church. She was able to kind of vouch for me that she's a nice lady. She's not going to abduct you. You can go off with the strange lady in a car and tell her what you remember about the neighborhood. And one of the women was a woman named Sarah Showalter, and John Halp was her adopted dad. She grew up in the back of this little store called Miss Irene's Store. He was married to Miss Irene. She had polio, but she ran this store really well. And Sarah was like her legs. She would go make change and then give it to the customers. And she delivered groceries in the neighborhood. It was one of those little stores where everybody had a credit account. And John Halp, who was married to Miss Irene, he was a black bail bondsman. And he was Mr. Austin's right hand. And so Sarah remembered in great detail, first of all, that they called each other by their first names, which have been highly unusual for a black person to call a white lawyer by his first name. But Mr. Halp had a lot of power in the community. I mean, next to the minister, like the bail bondsman was a pretty important person. And he was tall, dark, and handsome, impeccably dressed. He had a really nice new car. He drove lawyer Austin around. And it just became this, you know, Wilbur and John, these two pretty interesting duo that got it done for Harriet Muse.
It seems like they'd make a good TV show.
Exactly, exactly. And so unexpected in the 40s and 50s, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
It's almost kind of like Nero, Wolf, and Archie.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Truvine was the community they originally came from between Martinsville and Roanoke. And like so many other places in America, the name Truvine has a biblical origin to it.
Yeah. Yeah. It comes from Bible. They told me at the church recently, it's not in the book. I wish it was, but how did this community get its name? So it's named for the verse in the Bible, and it's really the community's name for the church, which still exists and is quite a small but vibrant church. And they said the first time a traveling minister came through in the late 1800s, they had church under a brush arbor. And the sermon he preached was John 15, I am the true vine and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. Every branch that bears fruit, he prunes that it may bear more fruit. And my sense is that to African Americans at that time, and there are a lot of Truvine Baptist churches around the South, probably elsewhere too, but the ones I'm familiar with are in the South. I know there's one not far away in Mount Airy, North Carolina. It was this notion that this vine is my connection to God, and you can do whatever you want to me, but if I have that connection and it's strong, I'm going to persist. I'm going to be okay. And so I just love that idea. And I got to know that community, so it seemed like a good title for the book.
And also, if you take it away from its biblical context, Truvine, the truth in this story is like a vine, and that it's long and very tangled.
That is so good. I'm going to steal that. That is really good.
So has Nancy Saunders read the book, and has she given you her opinion of it?
Yeah. So the book, you know, it ends at Willie's funeral. And when I turn the book in, it gets edited. It ends at Willie's funeral or his gravesite. And at that point, once it was edited, I printed it out and gave her a copy for fact-checking purposes. My editor said, I think it needs an epilogue. But he didn't really specify, like, he didn't tell me what it should say or what the tone of it should be. And I really didn't know what I was going to do. And anyways, I had given it to her. We were going by the cemetery one more time because we hadn't done that in a while to see his grave. And she was giving me her feedback there. Oh, I know why we were going there. I had found out where Harriet was buried. She didn't know where her great-grandmother Harriet was buried. I had found out she was in an unmarked grave in the same cemetery that George and Willie were buried. So we were going over to see Willie's grave and George's, but also to see where Harriet was. And they don't know for certain. There's a huge spans of unmarked graves there, but they know what year was when, so we know when she died. So she's one of these three or four graves. So we're able to kind of approximate it. And that ended up being part of my epilogue. And she didn't say one way or the other whether she liked the book. She didn't really comment on it.
Do you think she would have let you know if she had disapproved of it?
Yeah, because she did let me know that she said, I know you found documentation that suggests that Harriet may have initially let them go with the circus, but I don't care what you show me on that. I will never believe that she let her children go off with the circus. All she had was her children and her Christ, and she would have never done that. And I said, yes, but I have. Do you want to see the documents that I found? She said, no, I don't want to see them. I believe you found them. I know you didn't make it up. I'm just telling you what I feel based on the love that Willie Mews had for his mother. And so he's blind at the end of his life. He keeps a photo of her by his bed, and he, like, straightens it every night. It was his finest moment. Like, my mother came and found us. She got us back. My mother was not dead. And Nancy knows in her heart that didn't happen. And also, an interviewer asked me recently, Beth, what do you think? And nobody had ever asked me that, not even my editor. And I said, well, Willie himself said he was kidnapped from the circus. And I said, Nancy, did he say the word kidnapped? She said, no, he said he was stolen. She said it very pointedly. He was stolen. That's what he said. And my Uncle Willie wasn't a liar. So who am I to dispute that, to be one more person, like, not mocking but discounting his view? I mean, it was him.
And also the unreliability of the press.
Exactly. And the unreliability of the census documents, which are misspelled because they were illiterate. They didn't get their names right. I mean, I could never even find out exactly when they were born. There were such a varying degree of dates. And the documentation is just terrible for most African-American families back in that time. And that's nameless ancestors who were during slavery, who were only recorded by gender and value and approximate age. And then back when they did start being written down by name, many of them couldn't read because they couldn't go to school, the sharecroppers especially, and so their names wouldn't be recorded accurately. And so it's just another tragedy of slavery in the aftermath. Like, a lot of African American families don't know their history going back very far.
Now, the story has taken up a lot of your brain space for the last 25 years or so. Now that the book is out, mm-hmm. Do you think it goes away from your brain, or how do you think you're going to live with that story now that this major part of the work has been done on it?
Well, I kind of have a hunch that people will tell me things that I don't know, and I welcome that. I actually have a little place on my website, which is authorbethmacy.com. It says True Vine Feedback, and people can send me a note. So think about all those pitch cards that I mentioned. If you paid a little bit extra, you could actually get your picture taken with an act. So there's probably a lot of those pictures of just random people from Nebraska who wanted to get a picture taken with Eco and Ico, the ambassadors from Mars. So I would be really interested in seeing, you know, photographs. I think I've seen most of the press clippings, but probably not all, because every day newspapers are adding archives that weren't there before. I mean, some of the pictures I found in the book weren't even available when I first started researching the book 2 years ago. So I welcome other accounts, and if anybody has a memory, I would love to hear it.
Do you have another project, or are you just taking some time off?
Oh, I wish I was taking some time off. No, I'm early into a reported contemporary book on the opioid epidemic and struggling with a very dark topic, honestly. And I'm taking some time off that to promote this book. But I've been doing tons of interviews, and in between running around giving talks about this book, I'll be holed up in my hotel rooms, typing up my interview notes and trying to think of a way to tell a story that'll help people understand and hopefully boost awareness of this horrible epidemic.
Yeah, because with Truvine, so much that happened to the brothers and their mother was terrible and awful. And of course, dealing in that milieu of racism, of how pernicious it was and still is, but to a lesser extent. But there was, like, redemption and a happiness. The family finds each other again. But with the opioid epidemic, where is the light?
Right.
That story.
That is exactly my struggle. I actually said to my agent, can we give the advance back? I was really getting depressed. And just to be honest, another writer named Roland Lazenby, who we actually have the same editor at Little Brown, and he's a dear friend. He lives in Roanoke. He wrote the Michael Jordan book.
He's a West Virginia boy, isn't it?
Virginia.
He wrote Jerry West. I remember he wrote the Jerry West story.
That's right. And then he wrote the definitive biography of Michael Jordan. He has a book about to come out on Kobe Bryant. But we get together for beers every couple of months and just whine and moan about our deadlines and all of our issues. But he was saying, find the heroes. You're always best when you find the heroes. he sends me little notes and I print them out and stick them on my computer, you know, just things that I'm going to need a lot of support on this book. I think finding the heroes is the perfect way to tell that story. Who are the people that are making headway, who are really in the trenches, who are doing God's work with addicts, with people who have substance use disorder. And I found some pretty awesome people. So when I hold on to those stories, I feel good about it.
Well, Beth, I want to thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us, and thank you so much for writing Truevine.
You were a wonderful interviewer. Thank you so much for your interest.
Beth Macy is the author of Truevine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping, and A Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South, which is published by Little Brown. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.